shifted, you will never know what you might find.
That was so pretty. That was Frolic of the Bees with Phoebe Hunt on fiddle and vocals. Backup vocals, we have Stephanie Hunt and Gina Leslie. Accordion, Sam Ryder. Bass, Jared Engel. Guitar and vocals, Roy Williams. And on drums, we have Nicholas Falk. And this is sort of a joining of two bands, Phoebe Hunt and the Gatherers and Sam Ryder and the Human Hands. And so how did this joining together thing happen?
Well, it's been really, really organic, and mostly because we're all friends with each other who support one another's musical decisions and musical growth. And Roy here is also a great band leader. You know, we're not playing his original songs today, but just so you know, it kind of spreads throughout the whole band. Stephanie has, and Gina, everyone in the band has their own strengths, and we all make our own records, essentially, where we harness in on our own chi, if you will, like find the voice inside, and everyone else follows suit and helps support that. And so what you get is the music is completely different that comes from each one of us. You'll hear it later when we do the Human Hands, but we're the Gatherers right now.
Very cool. Your latest album, Shanti's Shadow, you said that you wanted to be as vulnerable and raw as possible in order to share your shadow. And I can see why. I mean, it's always good when people can wear their heart on their sleeve in a way in their art. But why was that important to you for this project? What sort of led you there and made you want to do that?
A long journey. A lot of places of just trying to discover my own true voice. I'm a fiddle player, so as a fiddle player, it's a very supportive role in a band, and I've been in lots of different bands. And so I've been just kind of searching for what is my true voice, and the people that I love the most are the ones who are able to strip off those extra layers. And so I was like, well, I'm going to do my best to just show my truest self. Mm-hmm. And even if it's the good and the bad and the ugly, you know?
Right. And you had been to India too, right? Part of that journey was when you went to India and you studied with an Indian violinist named Kala Ramnath.
Yep. A group of us in this room went. Roy was there and Jared was there and I was there and a few other friends in New York, and we just invited everyone to come, and we did a 2-week study. The violinists in India are very renowned. You know, people that, I'm a violinist. Oh, you know, that must mean you have a deep study ethic, and like that's really held high in esteem in India as far as the class system. Deep study seems to be a class of its own. So people who are either really spiritual and are studying all these different texts that take mm-hmm. dedication over periods of years. Music is like that in India, and the violin especially, because it emulates most the human voice. And the human voice is held in very high esteem in India also.
So you've traveled the world and you've also traveled the United States. What are some of the places in the United States where you feel like music is held in high regard, at the place where it should be held, if that makes any sense? Because mm-hmm. I feel like there's some communities and places around the country and the world where music's nice, but you know.
Yeah, rather than answering that geographically, I would answer that by like a type of mindset of person. And I think that the type of mindset of person who holds music in really high esteem actually are the festival goers of our country. Because I feel like the festivals that happen around our country are the places where the people that are doing the passing on the tradition of the lineages of music within our country also requires deep study, and people really hold those musicians in high esteem. So, for example, Telluride Bluegrass Festival, when you're on that stage, people are there to listen. And that happens not just on Planet Bluegrass stages, but at festival stages all around the country. And then, of course, there are theaters where people go. But I feel like the people themselves in the audience really show it at festivals. I don't really get that feeling back from any receive mm-hmm. that incredible. The feeling of really being heard, I get that feeling at a festival. And at house concerts. Mm. That sounds weird, but house concerts is another underground kind of thing happening in our country that by people who really, really esteem music and want to make sure that the musicians can continue to play it, and they host concerts in their own homes. And I think those people also really love music.
Festivals are good. Sometimes after the third or fourth day, I'm like, can I just live like this? Is there a way to just go from festival to festival?
That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. You have to be a musician, I guess.
You're the camper.
It's a really good world. And you're off to Telluride Bluegrass.
That's right.
So those of you that are listening, you can catch them there. And we'd love to hear another song from Phoebe Hunt and The Gatherers.
All right, here we go. This is a song I wrote when I first moved to New York City. And I moved there going, what do you do and how do you live in this big city? And what I did was I met all these great friends and they taught me how to live life. So this is called New York. 1, 2, 3, 4. Ah! Stone me cold, will it eat me up alive? I am a country girl with the city drive, and there's a small town waiting for me if I die. If I look back now, I'll be running for the rest of my life. City, sleep inside me, lead me home through the darkest night. Flying high, think of keeping cool, think of going deep inside. There is a wave to catch, there's a thrill to tell, there's a flowing stream, and there's a party tonight, there's a friend. had enough and never compromised. Ever pure of heart, ever open for another eye. And so I take your hand and I squeeze it tight, hoping you stick by and keep me warm at night. And we'll take this city by storm for the month of July.
City sleep inside me, leave me home.
When you sing, Phoebe, you really look like you, like it feels good.
Nothing better.
It makes me want to sing, but great. It wouldn't, I could look like that, but I couldn't sound like that. So, and if you're just joining us, I'm here with Phoebe Hunt and the Gatherers, joined by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands. And actually, we're going to jump into Sam's project a little bit more now. And, Welcome to Talkin' Music.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. So I was looking into your history a little bit, and I saw that you wrote your senior thesis comparing the songwriting of Woody Guthrie to Ira Gershwin. I'm wondering why you wanted to delve so deeply into those two artists and compare them, and I'm wondering what you came up with.
Let's see. There's a few reasons. I grew up as a classical and jazz pianist, and I come from a long line of pianists, and my dad was a musical theater composer, so I really sort of came up learning that those styles of music and that way of thinking about music. But then at the same time, my mom's family was really big into Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Arlo Guthrie and folk stuff like that. And when I got to college, I went to college to study just American studies, English, politics, anthropology, that kind of stuff. And when it came time to choose a subject to dive deeply into, I decided that the thing that I like the most about music is writing music, and songwriting in particular. And I settled on those two artists because one is this quintessential New York Jewish composer. Ira was the lyricist, but I was also looking at George. And in many ways, my own family felt very similar to theirs. And then the other person was Woody Guthrie, who comes from Okemah, Oklahoma, in the middle of America, and traveled all over. Or Woody, in particular, was such an incredible philosopher of humanity and of American culture. And the Gershwins, in their own right, did a lot in terms of sort of just thinking about American culture through their work. So I compared country and folk, this like what it means to write about rural America, and then I compared that with this like pop urbanism, and in the paper I guess I kind of showed how the two camps were actually really aware of each other. Yeah. And Woody was writing a lot of times in response to the pop music that he was hearing on the radio, Bing Crosby, or in particular Irving Berlin. He wrote This Land Is Your Land after hearing an Irving Berlin song. And then the Gershwins were really interested in all different types of American culture. And in Porgy and Bess, they did this kind of ethnographic study of the American South and wrote in the dialect of the Gullah Islands. I guess those two, and those are the two sides of my own writing, I guess is the moral of the story. Mm-hmm. I have this like musical theater and jazz and classical thing, but then I hang out with all these people.
Right. Well, it's interesting. It's almost like you can marry any kind of music, or any ideas can be married in music.
And
I'm never surprised anymore. Like what, you know, you're going to throw a Casio keyboard in with the banjo, and it doesn't, you know, there's no rules really.
Or an accordion in with a bluegrass ensemble.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so you started out more on piano.
Yes.
And then what? When did you decide to make the switch to accordion? What?
When I was in high school, my drama teacher needed a Middle Eastern drum that I had called a dumbek, And she asked me if she could borrow it. And I said, sure, but I'd like to trade you for your accordion. And so she gave me this old accordion, and I actually didn't end up playing it very much until one day I took it camping with my girlfriend, now wife, in California, and we went to this hot springs, and I left it in the trunk of the car. Once again, I decided not to play it. But when I took it out of the trunk of the car at the end of the weekend, it didn't make any sound. And
oh, no.
It turned out that if you leave an accordion in the trunk of a car, all the reeds melt. Because it gets too hot, and they're all held together with wax. I was going to tell this other story about how if you leave an accordion in a car, and there's a car thief, they take the car and leave the accordion. But that's a whole other thing. But anyway, so I brought the accordion to a store, and the woman at the store, which was called Accordion Apocalypse, told me that it would cost $700 to fix the damn thing. And so you know, at that moment, I was like, well, you either have to learn how to play it and get it fixed or just give it up altogether. So I decided to pay all this money. I brought it back to New York City to college, and I took it to a gig with our buddy Eddie, who's a saxophonist. And Eddie and I have played music together our whole lives, jazz. And we showed up at this art gallery in Brooklyn, and I had the accordion, and we started singing and playing some Hank Williams tunes. And all of a sudden, the feeling that I got from holding this instrument on my chest and facing the audience and singing and everything was just a much more fun and, like, interactive kind of music than I had ever experienced before. So it sort of became this weird, like, hit in our college circuit. We would play it at all these parties, standing on couches, and we would wear matching Western shirts and sing in three-part harmony. And
right.
I was playing accordion, and then that quickly kind of spiraled out of control, and all of a sudden I was playing accordion way more than the piano, and I was playing at, like, the Blue Note. On the accordion. I never thought I would be there on the accordion. I always wanted to be there on the piano, but that didn't happen. So then, and then 10 years later, here I am playing the accordion.
It just took off.
It's a really unusual instrument. It's definitely a niche that I found. But most importantly, the accordion is my sort of vehicle for exploring all these different styles of music from around the world that I really love. You find it all over the world. It's one of the world's most prominent instruments.
Well, let's hear another song if we could. And this is Sam Ryder and the Human Hands.
Yeah, okay, so we're going to play. I just put out a record in February, and this is the first track from the record. It's called The Murder.
Thank you.
And that was The Murderer.
That was The Murderer.
From Sam Ryder and The Human Hands. Sam, I wanted to ask you about something that you did. I guess you did it with The Human Hands. So you did something called Roots of Freedom. And I guess this is sort of like a curriculum and a performance that you could take to schools.
Wow, you really went deep on my website.
Well, yeah, this was a really...
That's amazing.
This project, I thought, was really interesting. Okay. So basically, the idea, and of course, I want you to talk more than I do about it, but the idea is that you demonstrate how the structure of a band can be a model for a functioning democratic society.
Yes, absolutely.
How does that work?
Well, one thing that I love this. This is the best interview I've ever had.
All right, good.
Okay, so the idea with The Human Hands is that, as Phoebe sort of alluded to, we tend to pass the leadership around. Okay, and so the idea is that with a group of people, it's possible for there to be co-leadership. And even within the context of when, just like I'm performing right now as the leader, even when I am directing the shots and calling who's taking solos and writing the music, there's still opportunities for, within the improvisation, everybody gets a moment to sort of take the music where they want it to go. Without even using our voices, we're able to make these very sort of subtle decisions about who's speaking at one point or playing, and who's responding. And I think that when we do this for kids, what I like to demonstrate is the ways in which the band can model these types of behavior. And I think it's pretty obvious when they see it happening on stage.
Right. And if there's one person that's having a hard time, they kind of take the whole deal down. In other words, people have to support each other in order for the whole thing to work.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I think to address that, it's important that there's a shared language. It doesn't work if one person doesn't understand the language. So there always has to be common ground. But that doesn't mean that you need to have years and years of musical training. Common ground can be as simple as a sentiment or a story, like... Mm-hmm. And this is what we'll do. We'll ask the kids, like, what's something? Well, maybe I'll ask you, what's something really, what's something sad that happened to you this week?
Well, I interviewed this guy who was a dreamer, and he was talking about what's happening on the border of Texas. And that was really sad to get his perspective. He just gave a personal... His own personal account completely brought it home for me.
Okay. So what if this was a school show, what I would do then is I would say, what kind of sound do you make with your voice when you're feeling despairing like that?
Oh, wow. let's see. Sobbing uncontrollably. I don't know if I've ever done this on Talk and Music before.
Right. First for everything.
Okay, so then I would give it to the bass, because the bass is the saddest instrument in the band. And I would say, hey, Jared, can you make this sound on the bass?
Works best for 9-year-olds.
That was pretty good. Wow. Can you make it even sadder? Right, so it's like really sad.
Oh, that's so despairing.
And then we could improvise something together maybe for just a second using that sound. Just stuff like that, basically.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to show people that it's possible to transform their feelings, their emotions, and their experiences into artwork that the artwork itself doesn't have to be sad. We can take a really hard experience like that, and we can make something that's uplifting or joyful. And that's really the power of music. So, when you see someone play the blues, the experience of that in the audience is actually often one of just like joy. You're dancing, and it's like really uplifting music. But the subject matter that it starts from can be very, very heavy.
Right. Well, it's partly because I think it becomes uplifting and joyous because you realize that somebody gets that feeling without words.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah.
Exactly. Well, there's an ambiguity there. It contains multitudes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, let's hear one more song before you go.
Cool. All right. We're going to sort of switch gears here and play a psychedelic song about a psychedelic plant that I stumbled across in the Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
It's not a psychedelic.
It's not actually a psychedelic plant, but it has a psychedelic name, which is the Swamp Dog Hobble. And this is track two on the record. Oh, and by the way, the record is called Too Hot to Sleep, and it's available in all the right places.